You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up, we have Sojourner Truth Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Development Committee will meet the first Wednesday of each month at 4:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Multnomah County District Attorney Candidate Forum on Sunday, December 1st, from 1:30 to 4:30 p.m. at the Midland Branch of the Multnomah County Library in Portland. The Multnomah County District Attorney is one of the most powerful elected persons in the state. Several candidates are running for this office. All candidates have been invited to attend, speak to the audience, and answer questions. Again, that's the Multnomah County District Attorney Candidate Forum on Sunday, December 1st, from 1:30 to 4:30 p.m. at the Midland Branch of the Multnomah County Library, 805 Southeast 122nd Avenue. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today on Campaigners for Black Lives, Dr. Malina Abdullah joins us to talk about Black Christmas and also, or Black Xmas, to give us an update on the Black Lives Movement. Also, we spend most of the hour on what people are increasingly calling Thanksgiving. People across the nation are on the road or shopping, cooking for the Thanksgiving meal. But what really was behind the founding of Thanksgiving? What was the original intent of the holiday? And why are Native Americans referring to Thanksgiving as a day of mourning? Our guest is Larry Smith. He is a member of the Lumbee Nation and the co-producer and co-host of American Indian Airwaves, one of the longest-running Indigenous public affairs radio programs. Also, our weekly Earth Minute with Ann Peterman. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Before we go to our news headlines, let's go to a clip of Native Americans making the case for Thanksgiving as a day of mourning.
Whose land?
Ireland.
Whose land?
Ireland.
What do we want?
Justice.
When do we want it?
Now.
Thanksgiving for us is a day of mourning because it represents the day when the Pilgrims first settled here in New England, and they started their reign of tyranny and genocidal acts amongst the Indigenous tribes. We shouldn't be teaching children 1492 Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Columbus was a murderer and a rapist.
Since the invasion of Columbus and the rest of the Europeans, Native people have been virtually non-stop victims of terrorism.
It's complicated because I also want to spend time with my family, and we do have the tradition of celebrating Thanksgiving, but there's definitely a big part of me that every time we sit down for Thanksgiving wants to talk about injustice and the fact that we're like living on stolen land.
We tried to feed them and take care of them because the Pilgrims wouldn't have made it through the winter without us. and they paid us back by savagely abusing us and murdering us and enslaving us, stealing our crops.
And that you heard the voices of Native American people and their supporters about Thanksgiving as a day of mourning. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. An official at the White House Office of Management and Budget testified privately to the House Intelligence Committee that two other OMB officials resigned earlier this year over President Trump's decision to withhold congressional military aid approved for Ukraine. The Intelligence Committee has released Mark Sandy's deposition. He said one of the other officials raised questions about the legality of withholding the aid. Republicans have pointed to the fact that Trump ultimately released the aid without Ukraine's president bowing to his demand to publicly announce an investigation of Joe and Hunter Biden, but two unidentified sources confirmed that Trump's decision to release his hold on the aid in September came only after he became aware of a whistleblower complaint against him. Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal told CNN the new information adds to the evidence against Trump in the impeachment probe.
It empowers further the case against the president. It confirms the evidence coming from the president's own mouth. Really, it's still the July 25th conversation about doing us a favor in return for the aid, soliciting a bribe, in a sense. And what this report shows, very, very importantly, is the president decided to release the aid when he knew his cover was blown. He was caught.
The House Judiciary Committee announced it will hold a hearing next Wednesday on the constitutional grounds for presidential impeachment. Committee Chair Gerald Nadler has written to President Trump inviting him or his attorney to attend with a Sunday deadline to respond. Three workers were injured early this morning in a massive explosion at a Texas chemical plant. The blast blew out the windows and doors of nearby homes and spread a toxic plume of smoke that stretched for miles. The plant in Port Neches in southeast Texas, about 80 miles east of Houston, makes chemical and petroleum-based products. Just days ago, the Trump administration reversed chemical plant safety measures that were put in place after a Texas fertilizer plant explosion in 2013. That explosion killed 15 people, including 10 firefighters. Last week's changes by the Environmental Protection Agency included ending a requirement that plants provide members of the public information about chemical risks upon request. Environmental groups criticized the decision as one that would put people living near chemical plants at greater risk. Airline catering workers held protests at airports busy with Thanksgiving holiday travel. They were scheduled to demonstrate at 17 airports around the country. At San Francisco International, 350 rallied. 50 catering workers and supporters were arrested, including three members of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. Unite Here Local 2 says less than 50% of workers at the SFO airline catering kitchens had company health insurance in 2018. Only 10% had a child or other family member covered. Melanie Cruz said she put off needed surgery because she couldn't afford it.
I wasn't able to do my surgery for a whole year because I had to save for it. So, in other words, my medical is very, very expensive. So, throughout the year, I had to live with the pain. And also, after my surgery, I'm in like debt with my medical as well. And what we're here today to do is, fight for affordable medical.
The workers are also demanding better wages. Amnesty International says in a new report that Egypt's government is using a secretive judicial agency designed to fight terrorism to detain peaceful protesters, journalists, and critics on trumped-up charges without trial. Amnesty's report says concert goers were accused of terrorism for waving rainbow-colored flags. A journalist charged with broadcasting false news was detained repeatedly for 3 years. A human rights lawyer was arrested for joining a protest he says he didn't attend. Several Christians were imprisoned for aiding a terrorist group a reference to the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood organization. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo yesterday said Egypt should respect freedom of the press. Hours later, Egyptian police made six new arrests, including three journalists in central Cairo. In September, President Trump called Egyptian leader Abdel Fattah al-Sisi my favorite dictator. The Albanian Defense Ministry says the death toll from Tuesday's earthquake has now reached 26. 650 people were injured. Rescuers are still digging through rubble in search of survivors. I'm Eileen Alfandari for Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to start off with our Campaigners for Black Lives, which is back after a long hiatus due to fund drive and travel, et cetera. Dr. Melina Abdullah, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having us, Margaret. Happy to be back.
Okay, Dr. Melina Abdullah, professor, author, community campaigner in Los Angeles, professor, chair of the Pan-African Studies Department at Cal State University, L.A., and she is one of the founding members, a founder of Black Lives Matter Los Angeles, and has very well known now to our audience in Southern California. So, Dr. Abdullah, well, I'll just call you Melina, right? Because I know you.
Absolutely.
Okay, Melina. tell us, what would you like to share with us today? What are you going to talk about?
Sure. So we're moving into the season where, you know, we've been kind of bombarded with this notion of consumerism, trying to get us to spend, give our money to places like Walmart and Target and all of these companies that really benefit from our oppression and finance our oppression. If we think about the role of some banks, Citibank, Wells Fargo and others, you were just talking about banks taking. Many of these banks finance the Dakota Access Pipeline. They finance private prisons, and we're giving them our dollars. And so since 2014, Black Lives Matter has been developing this program that we call Black Xmas, where we're encouraging everybody to be more intentional with their dollars, recognizing that state-sanctioned violence against black people is also tied to white supremacist capitalism or racial capitalism. And so we need to think about how do we divest from the system and how do we invest in the things that actually make communities safe and build black community. And so we, building on kind of, I think our eyes were opened most clearly in 2014 when John Crawford was killed inside of a Walmart store while he was holding Walmart merchandise, a BB gun, right? And so what's the role of Walmart in his murder, right? In Los Angeles, we can think about Albert Ramon Dorsey and Dennis Todd Rogers both being killed inside 24-hour fitness locations when workers called police on these black male gym members, and then police came in and killed both Dennis and Albert Ramon Dorsey in two different incidents, one in 2017 and one in 2018. And so what we're trying to do is say that during this time of year, from Black Friday to January 1st, let's be intentional with our dollars and let's resist consumerism. So the first call that we're making is asking people not to spend on things that you don't need. So rather than buying, think about investing in black-led community organizations. So instead of getting your aunt another sweater that she doesn't need, maybe she loves the arts. So you can donate in her name to places like the Fernando Pullum Center, which is right in Leimert Park and offers absolutely free music and theater and dance programs to our children, right? She, I think, loved that. Right? So we're the first call that we're making is to build black. Give your dollars to black-led community organizations, and there's a whole list of them at blackxmas.org. Then, if you have to buy something, we want you to think about buying with black businesses that benefit the community. So we have places like My Two Cents and Simply Wholesome that hire you know, black folks, black young folks, black formerly incarcerated folks, and offer healthy food to our communities, right? You can also think about, there's a black skateboard shop. If your kid absolutely needs a skateboard, buy it from rad black kids, right? Don't buy it from the white corporations. Don't go to Walmart. You can go to rad black kids and get a skateboard. And then finally, we're encouraging people to bank black. And here in Los Angeles, we have a couple of black banks, the largest one being One United Bank, which has been very intentional and very involved in the bank black movement, moving our money to black-owned banks, which is not just about making sure that the bank is black, but also thinking about the ways in which these banks operate differently than these large banks, right? So if you walk into One United on Crenshaw and Obama, there's no safety glass, right? There, people know you by your name. They have black artists in there every Thursday playing live music. There's coffee and cookies for folks, and the last time I was in there, there were two houseless brothers sitting there on the couch and being welcomed into the space, which is a very different reaction than you would have gotten at a Bank of America. So those are our kind of calls: build black, buy black, and bank black, and all of that is up on blackxmas.org, including some really cool assets, like you can download a card that says, don't buy me anything for the holidays, donate in my name too, and then you can fill in the black organization you want donated to.
Right, thank you for that, Melina, and I'm going to lobby you a little bit here, a little unusual, because I'm wondering if some international solidarity could be considered by Black Lives Matter, even if it doesn't work for this year, perhaps next year, because I always like to encourage people to give to the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund that goes directly to supporting the movement on the ground in Haiti. So perhaps that's something we could talk a bit about.
No, we can do that right now. So when we get off,
well, that's news.
Me the website, and we'll add that to our Build Black link, so uh-huh. that people have that, because we are a Pan-African organization, recognizing that the freedom of black people all around the world is bound together.
That would be absolutely terrific, the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. So this is a boycott of white capitalism, right, during this holiday season. Dr. Melina Abdullah, for people, though, who do want to support all of the ongoing work that you all are doing in Black Lives Matter LA, what should they do?
Sure. So join us. We need people on the front line. So every Tuesday morning, we're in front, and we're at LA Police Commission meetings, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. at 100 West 1st Street. Every Wednesday, not today, we did a surprise action on Monday, but every Wednesday, other than Thanksgiving Eve, we're in front of Jackie Lacey's office demanding that she step down. So Wednesdays at 4 to 11 West Temple, and all of this is posted on our social media. So Twitter is BLMLA, Instagram is BLM Los Angeles, and they can always go to our website at BLMLA.org. And I just want to remind people, we're just regular folks. None of us work for Black Lives Matter. I'm just a mom of three kids who, we just, have to fight for our own freedom. So if you believe in the freedom of black folks, whether you're black or not, please get involved in Black Lives Matter.
Right. And Lena, on the story just before you dash of Jackie Lacey, we have seen it certainly district attorneys more, I don't know if you could call it progressive, but perhaps we could use those words in Philadelphia, for example, and also in San Francisco. You know, we've seen in Philadelphia, Larry Krasner, I don't recall the name of the person in
Boudin,
San Francisco.
Chelsea Boudin.
Right. So are we seeing a kind of a shift of people really, you know, lobbying and pushing for district attorneys that would be more in line with, you know, protecting the people as opposed to just propping up illegal action by law enforcement?
I think so. I think you have more than one model of what a district attorney can be. So definitely Larry Krasner in Philly, definitely what Chelsea Boudin is talking about in San Francisco, Marlon Mosby in Baltimore. Uh-huh. You have an incredible young district attorney candidate, Audia Jones, who's running for Harris County district attorney in Houston. She's a member of Democratic Socialists of America. We have alternative models of district attorneys who remember that when they walk into the courtroom, their title says the people. Mm-hmm. So how are they representing the people? And so I think that the push that we're making here in Los Angeles has been really important. The LA Times and the New York Times both call this district attorney's race the most important in 2020, or the second most important in 2020 after the presidential race. So we want to remember that pressure works, and we have to remove district attorneys that really act as extensions of a police state. We have to challenge the district attorney's office to actually represent the people. On Monday, when we were in front of Jackie Lacey's office, it was a surprise pop-up action. We didn't announce it on social media. And so when we got to the Hall of Justice, which on Wednesdays is barricaded and heavily guarded by LA County sheriffs, it was wide open. And so we walked into the building,
yeah,
and immediately were confronted by sheriffs and then told, as they put their hands on the mother of Christopher DeAndre Mitchell, who was killed on December 9th by Torrance police, they put their hands on Sister Cheryl Lynn Haynes and said that they were going to arrest us for walking into a public building. Then they threatened us with quote-unquote bodily harm. They said this over the loudspeaker, that if we didn't, we actually exited the building and stood on the public steps, and they still came after us and threatened bodily harm. This is the kind of district attorney that we have in Los Angeles, and it's why for over 2 years we've been saying Jackie Lacey must go. But nationally, we also see a movement building. We can think about the Real Justice PAC and other organizations and organizers in Sacramento and all around the country. Think about what just happened in Queens, pushing for district attorney's offices to prosecute police who kill our people, to stop incarcerating black folks at rates that are not in line with the crimes that are committed, right? At relying on corrupt police, allowing for corruption in their own offices. We're calling for a new way of doing criminal justice, which is really rooted in abolitionism.
Right. And, you know, have to remind people that Jackie Lacey is black. And because somebody is black doesn't necessarily mean that they're on our side or on the right side. And on that count, I just saw an article this morning. I haven't read it yet. I think it was in the New York Times about Julian Castro, who is a presidential candidate and speaking out about poverty and visiting a camp, a homeless camp in Oakland. Now, he was not part of the last Democratic presidential debate, and looking at the lineup as it stands now for the December debate, he is not there as well. But I do know that because I'm active with the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for the moral revival, that when we had a Poor People's Congress in June of this year in Washington, D.C., there was a presidential debate there, and all of the candidates were asked to commit to there being at least one debate where they focus on poverty. And we really haven't seen that yet. But I was interested to note that Julian has been the one candidate I've seen that, saying something about poverty. I'm wondering what you think about all this. And what I've heard also, somebody said, well, you know, if Julian was white, he likely still would be, up on the debate stage in terms of support.
Yeah, absolutely. Today, Julian Castro just released his plan to end hunger in this country. He's been the only candidate that we've seen speak explicitly about poor people. So one of the things that he said is that the other candidates are talking about the middle class and working people, but we need to talk about poor people. If you go to his website, one of the opening quotes is an Audre Lorde quote, which immediately, you know, took me aback because I haven't seen that from a presidential candidate. And I think that you're absolutely right. When we think about what's happening with this race, you've seen an over coverage of the white candidates. So people like Pete Buttigieg, who there's a tremendous article out right now in The Root that says Pete Buttigieg is a lion MF. That's the title of the article. But it goes through how, you know, Pete Buttigieg is basically a media-made candidate. He's a mayor of a city that it only took him 8,000 votes to win. I have more Twitter followers than that, right? But he's been
Melina kind of, for president, right?
No. But Mayor Pete has been propped up as this darling while they've completely ignored Julian Castro. Even people like Kamala Harris and Cory Booker have been basically erased from the media coverage. Now, they've maintained their place on the stage so far, but I know Cory was looking at not being on in November. He's been talking about the possibility of dropping out. And I think that has a lot to do with the way that corporate media ignores candidates of color, and it's part of this ongoing, you know, institutionalized white supremacy. And so I think that we have an opportunity to kind of dig a little bit deeper, and we want to challenge listeners to, you know, go to Julian Castro's site, right? Look and see if those are things that his priorities are your priorities, and if so, then how do we engage in a grassroots campaign to make sure that his voice is heard. Charlotta Bass, who famously ran for vice president in the early 20th century, you know, we can talk about viability, right, about the ability to win the seat, but the importance of people like Julian Castro being on the stage is also there. And what Charlotta Bass said is, win or lose, we win by raising the issues. When Julian Castro is not on the stage, he doesn't get to raise the issues. And so we can talk about that. It wasn't the dollars that got him off stage. What got him off stage was polling, where they're polling people using landline polls, which nobody uses a landline phone anymore, and it especially skews towards white, more affluent, and less urban communities. And so they're not going to be the voters that are going to support someone like a Julian Castro. So we have to do our own work, our own due diligence to make sure that his voice is heard.
Right. Well, on that note, we did cover a range of things here for our Campaigners for Black Lives series. Thank you, Dr. Melina Abdullah. Thank you
so much, Sister Margaret.
All righty. And that's a part of our weekly series. What we're going to do now, actually, is go straight to our Earth Minute, which is back with Ann Peterman.
In December, Chile was supposed to host the annual UN Climate Summit, but a massive popular uprising forced Chile to cancel it. Chileans are demanding an end to unjust economic and political policies left over from Pinochet. President Piñera has responded with violent crackdowns, leaving thousands jailed and injured and at least 20 dead. Now Spain will host the climate summit. Chile will retain the summit presidency. Piñera will save face, and Chile's unfolding human rights disaster will be hidden from international scrutiny. Every year, these UN climate summits result in nothing but empty promises and non-binding commitments while climate catastrophe deepens. This year, the UN is promoting business for nature schemes designed to commodify and privatize nature. The plan: use the natural world to offset ongoing destruction of the earth while pretending to address climate change. But in Chile, a cumbre or people summit will take place to say, ya basta, enough already, and bring people together to discuss a new way forward, one based on ecology and justice, not profits. For the Earth Minute and the Sojourner Truth Show, this is Ann Peterman from Global Justice Ecology Project.
All righty, what we're going to do now is to take our station break, and the rest of the hour we'll be discussing, well, what's really behind Thanksgiving? How did it all get started, and the mythology behind what increasingly is being called Thanks-taking? Larry Smith in studio with us. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:29 a.m. Next up, at 9, we have Radio Zine Presents 20 Years to the Battle of Seattle, Globalization, Anarchism, and Indie Media. Now back to more Sojourner Truth.
The voice of our forefathers sing. The will to live will be done. We will no longer be pawns. To greed and to war, we will be idle no more.
All righty, and that song of Sing Our Own Song, Buffy St. Marie. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Check out our website at sotrueradio.org. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook, and our handle on Twitter and Instagram at sotrueradio. We're also on SoundCloud and nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. By the way, you can download a free app for SoundCloud. And today we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Cyprus, California, in Cyprus, California. And internationally, we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Egypt. Really difficult time happening now in Egypt, and we want to give a shout out to our sisters and brothers on the ground there making that struggle. Now, millions of people across the United States are either on the road to visit relatives or shopping for turkeys and other trappings to celebrate Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving was first proclaimed by Governor John Winthrop of the Massachusetts Bay Colony way back in 1637. Then following the Civil War, author Sarah Josepha Buell Hale is credited with popularizing the idea of Thanksgiving, and she has become known as the grandmother of Thanksgiving. Now, Thanksgiving was declared a national holiday in 1863 by President Lincoln. The holiday takes place nationally on the fourth Thursday in November. Now, in the novel, in Buell Hale's novel Northwood, she argued that establishing a nationwide Thanksgiving celebrating would help bring the country together amid growing division. Now, we have to keep in mind the historic context of her novel, the growing threat of the U.S. Civil War between the Union and the Confederacy, a fight really about slavery. And Hale's idea of Thanksgiving was to try to unite people. However, it was only limited to white people and explicitly excluded black people. In fact, she openly advocated for the removal of free black people from the United States, even writing a book called Liberia, named after West African country of Liberia, that portrays the American colonization society as in a positive light. Now, the American Colonization Society was established in 1816 by Robert Finley of New Jersey to encourage and support the migration of free African Americans to the continent of Africa. Now, you may have some thoughts about that. I mean, if somebody offered a number of us a ticket and some reparations right now and said, well, you could either go back to Africa or to the Caribbean, some people may, in fact, pick that up. But in recent years, Thanksgiving has also become associated with eating turkey. So why turkey? Those poor turkeys. Because in the colonies, they gathered wild fowl and turkeys, part of the hunt for fowl. And colonist William Bradford wrote in his book of Plymouth Plantation that Native Americans hunted wild turkey. And he, dig this, Alexander Hamilton once said, quote, "No citizen of the U.S. shall refrain from turkey on Thanksgiving Day." So the eating of turkey was in part justification of the fictional story of Native people, indigenous people, and colonists just getting along so happily, sitting down, eating turkey, giving thanks together. And there's even an ongoing tradition whereas U.S. presidents pardon turkeys, and Trump did his bit, pardoning turkey yesterday. And the first Thanksgiving turkey on record was pardoned in 1963 by John F. Kennedy, who received a 40-pound turkey with a sign around its neck that read, "Good eating, Mr. President." I'm sorry, all you vegans up there that are getting increasingly upset listening to this. Since then, major poultry companies use marketing to closely associate turkeys with Thanksgiving, making it a staple dish of the holiday. But what is the real story of Thanksgiving? What was the original intent of the holiday? Why are Native Americans saying that Thanksgiving is a day of mourning? We're going to hear a clip all about that. But before we hear the clip, I'd like to welcome in studio, really delighted, Larry Smith, who is a member of the Lumbee Nation, co-producer and co-host of American Indian Airwaves, one of the longest running Indigenous public affairs radio programs. He is an adjunct faculty member at Cal State University, Long Beach, in the Department of Film and Electronic Arts, and his academic interests includes Indigenous media policy and sovereignty, the federal Indian and communication law, media democracy, decolonization methodologies, propaganda and censorship in the United States mass media landscape. Well, I've been trying to get you in here on this show for a while, Larry, so thank you for coming in. It took Thanksgiving to bring you in.
Hello, thank you, Margaret, and I'd like to acknowledge the people of the land, the Tongva, Gabarino, the Tataviam, the Chumash, and to the south of here, the Juanino and the Hachiman peoples. Glad to be here.
All righty. Thank you. Thank you for that. What we're going to do now is to go to a clip and, you know, that gives us some background about what really happened and what we all have to pause and think about.
The Thanksgiving America celebrates on the last Thursday of November was proclaimed by Governor Winthrop of the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1637 to honor a massacre of indigenous peoples. The governor wrote that for the next 100 years, every Thanksgiving day ordained by a governor was in honor of the bloody victory, thanking God that the battle had been won. The first Thanksgiving meal in 1621 was no fairy tale story between the Pilgrims and the Wampanoag, Pequot, and Narragansett people. And in fact, in October of 1621, 1 year before Tisquantum, a.k.a. Squanto, died, when the Pilgrim survivors of the first winter on Turtle Island, a.k.a. America, the Pilgrims, who had a miserable crop that year, invited a native named Massasoit to their meal. Massasoit followed the indigenous tradition of equal sharing and invited many from his nation. Much of the food brought to that meal was provided by the natives, as they had much more of a bountiful harvest that year. There was no turkey, no squash, no cranberry sauce, or pumpkin pie. The first meal was in essence the beginning of the end. And in 1637, members of the Pequot Nation gathered to celebrate the Green Corn Festival. 700 men, women, and children from the Pequot Nation came together to celebrate, and as they were sleeping in the hours just before the sun rose, the English Pilgrims surrounded and massacred all of them, shooting and beating those that confronted them and burning the rest. After the massacre of over 700 Pequot men, women, and children, the next day, the governor of Massachusetts Bay Colony declared a day of Thanksgiving and celebrated the killing of the Pequot peoples. Pilgrims fed off the momentum of their victory and continued to slaughter indigenous men, women, and children. A second Thanksgiving feast was had after another massacre of the Pequot peoples in Stamford, Connecticut. In 1777, all 13 of the United States colonies held Thanksgiving celebrations, a continuation of the first celebration in 1637. In 1789, President George Washington declared November 26 a national day of Thanksgiving. And on October 3, 1863, President Abraham Lincoln finally made it official with a Thanksgiving proclamation, declaring Thanksgiving a national holiday. Thus, you can see that the American Thanksgiving holiday we know today is indelibly tied to the first Thanksgiving in 1637, which celebrated the massacre of millions of indigenous people.
That is quite something. We want to thank Irene Montantes.
Montoyas.
For putting that together. Irene is also part of the KPFK family, volunteering with our newsroom, and also part of the Poor People's Campaign, the Los Angeles Steering Committee of it. And that's where I first heard her read this, actually, at our meeting this past Sunday. And I'll have to say, Larry, there were a lot of wet eyes, including mine, after this, the idea that the first Thanksgiving was a celebration of a massacre.
That's not everything that happened. Actually, under Stiles, Standish Miles, who is basically the captain, right, of the plantation, he ordered the massacre of the Pequots while they were conducting their green corn harvest ceremony. But they actually surrounded the longhouse in which they were conducting the ceremony. They set it on fire. So of those 700 people that were massacred, those that didn't burn to death as they fled the longhouse, they actually shot them, stabbed them, and killed them as they fled the burning longhouse. And that's the story that nobody ever hears about. And the other story that, or the other part of that story, which is rooted in the history of this country, is the role that religion plays. And I think that's important, that the Puritans, right, were separatists. Some of them referred to themselves as saints, others as purists, if you will. They viewed indigenous peoples as non-human beings. They were objectified, dehumanized. They were less than. And so in their mind, the killing of indigenous peoples was doing God's will.
And that's connected to those papal bulls that are still have not been rescinded. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. I mean, the papal bulls takes us back to the Vatican, you know, in 1453 and then 1452 and 1493. And the Vatican was the international theological judicial power, if you will, on Mother Earth. And the church issued two papal bulls basically justifying colonists, European countries, right to discover quote-unquote new lands, right, and then to conquest those lands. And so for indigenous peoples within Africa, they were the involuntary participants in the executors using the papal bulls, the legal theological justification for what I would refer more aptly as theological fascism in beginning that process of colonizing indigenous peoples within the continent of Africa and committing nefarious intergenerational acts of genocide. And then that later, right, comes over here to the Western Hemisphere. And what's so, and so those two papal bulls are the legal and theological instruments for colonists to come in and quote unquote discover and conquest indigenous peoples and their respective First Nations lands. And those papal bulls are codified in the U.S. Supreme Court watershed court case, Johnson v. McIntosh in 1821. And that court case, along with two other court cases, are cited in every U.S. Supreme Court case that directly and indirectly pertains to indigenous peoples and their respective First Nations. And there are well over 5,000 court cases that directly and indirectly apply to indigenous peoples, and that corpus of law is more aptly referred to as a form of juridical imperialism.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's quite something as people are sitting down, and I understand people want to see their families, and they travel long distance of families, and they want to get together and give thanks for all good things that have happened to them, their loved ones during the year. But we really have to remember, I mean, the idea of a holiday beginning to give thanks for a massacre of 700, at least 700 men, women, and children is really hard to comprehend. I mean, for example, Romero and I were down in Haiti covering the massacre, the massacres, a series that have happened beginning in La Saline there. And the idea that then a national holiday in Haiti would be established to, you know what I mean, to give thanks for the fact this massacre has happened. We have to put it in perspective. And also that the pre-contact indigenous population in the Americas is said to be as high as 112 million people in 1492. This, according to scholars, but by 1650, the figure had declined to less than 6 million people. So this is all part of what you're talking about, Mary.
Absolutely. And today, you know, if you want to use the U.S. Census as a reference, indigenous peoples make up about 2% of the entire American population. Now, that's indigenous peoples within the politically defined borders of the United States. So there are indigenous peoples from elsewhere that now live here and call that home, and that's not part of that 2%. But I think what the mythology of Thanksgiving, rooted in genocide, rooted in forms of hatred, rooted in the diminishment of diversity, cultural diversity and biodiversity. So, you know, you were talking about the turkey, right, and the pardoning of the turkey. Well, one of the effects of this holiday is the colonial mono-industrialization of our food system. And so if you want to talk about, you know, indigenous turkeys from the East Coast, there was over 14 species of indigenous turkeys. But one has been commodified and industrialized and mass-produced, or is mass-producing these concentrated animal feed operations that most Americans, you know, purchase their turkeys from. And so that has diminished to the biodiversity of this relation, right, turkeys. And you can say the same thing with other parts of our food system, or what Americans think of as part of our food system. So whether it be squash, whether it be cranberries, all those crops have been industrialized, you know, with biotech industry. They've come in, they've destroyed or dominated these ecosystems in order, like with the cranberries, in order to industrialize this monocropping system, specifically to provide for Americans when they celebrate this mythological meal on Thanks But No Thanks Day.
Yeah, and, you know, showing really the interrelationship with the holiday, you so beautifully broke it down with the attack on the environment and the attack on, and I love the idea of turkeys being a relation, and I know among indigenous people in this country and in so many parts of the world where we do think of other other living things that are not human beings, as they are, we are related from the turkeys to the trees, you know, to the four-leggeds, as we call it.
Yeah, and so, you know, that notion of a day of mourning, it's just not the ancestors of the involuntary, that were involuntary participants in this quaint term settler colonialism. Yeah. It is the destruction and the loss of life of all relations, the two-legged, the four-legged, the air, the sea, the plants, and the animals. And if you just look
at... And this is the crisis we're facing right now.
Exactly. And so if you just look at indigenous peoples today, indigenous peoples live in, that have some remnants of their traditional homelands left, they live in some of the most biodiverse regions on Mother Earth. And so as indigenous peoples are, you know, systematically being killed off. And I don't mean just physically, but I also mean, you know, culturally, that the colonial conditions are so entrenched in our daily lives that it controls what we do, how we think, and those thoughts and actions, right, support a colonial way of life as opposed to a traditional way of life, that as we are killed off, so is the biodiversity of the land.
Yeah, and I remember in high school actually being taught that, well, no point including indigenous people, Native Americans, into statistics because they're going to be extinct. I mean, the idea that you're talking that they're going to be extinct, I think, like by 1980 or something like that is just is just outrageous. But we also have to remember when we talk about poverty in the U.S., when we talk about police abuse, indigenous people overall are the most impoverished community in the Americas. I mean, some people look at some of the tribes that are doing gaming and saying, well, those people over there, they're making money. That is not the vast majority of indigenous people. The highest suicide rate among teenagers, indigenous people, and indigenous women, like the black women in South LA, street women being killed and disappeared as though their lives absolutely have no value and referred to as no humans involved. But I want to, you see, you're going to have to come back, Larry, because one of the things I do want to just mention briefly here is I got a press release from the Poor People's Campaign entitled Apache Leader Prepares to Die in Order to Protect Sacred Land in San Carlos, Arizona. And this is the Oak Flat. And I think we do have a short clip, do we, on Oak Flats? Could we do that right now?
Right below us, right where we're sitting down, where I'm standing, they're going to go a mile deep, and they're going to dig a big hole that's equivalent to 1,400 cowboy stadiums, if you can imagine that.
A lot of times when you take on these fights, you think, you know, nobody knows that we're here. Nobody knows they're going to big hole in our backyard. Who's going to help us out? Well, the people here that you see here today, all these people here, Native and non-Native, are here to show you they support you and you're not alone. So go home when you leave here today and say, you know, we have a lot of friends. We have a lot of supporters out there that love us and they care about us and they care about the earth like we do.
And this is just going to keep happening. They're going to keep coming and keep coming. The Hmong people are going to keep coming and taking these sacred sites one at a time, unless we can all come together and figure out how to stop them.
Now, therefore, I, Terry Ramler, chairman of the San Carlos Apache tribe, by virtue of the authority vested in me by the amended constitution and bylaws of the tribe, do hereby proclaim this day, Oak Flat Day, the day we fight to take back Oak Flat. I call upon all nations, tribes, natives, and indigenous people, and everyone throughout the world to join with us to pray in accordance with our own faith and conscience for the blessing of Oak Flat, for its protection, for its safety, and for our Creator's continuing guidance, grace, and protection, so that Congress may repeal the act, and so that we can take back Oak Flat. In witness whereof I have hereunto set my signature, together with the leaders present, the 7th day of February in the year of our Lord, 2015.
All righty. So there we had some background. Oak Flat, a very, very sacred place for the Apache Nation. And a background of this, apparently, Senator John McCain, clearly, he added a last-minute rider back in 2014 to a defense spending bill, giving resolution copper rights to dig beneath Oak Flat and mine copper ore located thousands of feet below the surface. Now, Larry, this area is known as a very, very sacred site. And we had also been covering the controversy about the building of a telescope in Hawaii on Mauna Kea, which is again, a very, very sacred site. And what people don't get, it's like the equivalent of, I don't know what, building, you know, tearing down the Vatican and doing right. some mining underneath it.
Right.
You know, so tell us a little about, because this isn't only, the Oak Flat struggle is what happening right now, right. but we know even here for the local nations in yeah. Southern California yes. and throughout the Americas, this mm-hmm. is a ongoing battle.
Yeah, and even back home in the Carolinas and Virginia, we're fighting
back
the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, right? A 660-mile natural gas pipeline, which they want to expand another couple hundred miles so they can export the gas out of the Charleston port in South Carolina. And so, you know, as indigenous peoples, you know, that we are place-based peoples. And again, going back to that notion of relationality in our tradition, and the idea that everything is sacred, and so anytime there's a threat to the land, there's, you know, this development by companies, it is a destruction, it is an annihilation, it is an eradication, not just of sacred sites, but every cultural aspect of our traditional ways of being that's connected to that land. So it's so much more than just the destruction of a sacred site. It is also the permanent loss of everything culturally that's connected to that land based on our oral traditions and our creation stories. So when that land's gone, you might, if the stories survive and are passed down intergenerationally, the means for cultural expression to live and breathe the culture die.
Yeah, and also in talking with some of the women who are active with the Indigenous Environmental Network, they really lament that with the waters being polluted, right. but also a lot of the healing herbs and plants right. That are traditionally used in the community and also in ceremony, right. that they become contaminated, and that this right. fundamentally is a crisis. And I also read that for the native people in up north across the alleged border,
right.
Who have these ice boxes right. where they store, meat and other things for when the whole community is having ceremony, and then individual families have right. ice boxes that are dug in the permafrost. And what is happening now because of global warming, that they go into the ice box and there's water at the bottom.
Yeah.
I mean, the
yeah.
thing is melting. The food is
yeah.
spoiling.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, this is having a devastating impact.
And I think the other, you know, part of that conversation too is that we need to acknowledge, and you kind of alluded to this in talking about indigenous peoples here in what we know as Los Angeles County, but California indigenous peoples up the coastline where the Alta Spanish mission system was created. That was a torrential system of genocide perpetuated against California indigenous peoples. And it's no coincidence that those survivors do not have a land base today. And so these other mm-hmm. struggles, you know, indigenous nations that are federally recognized have some land base where there's a, you know, this the struggle on the grassroots level. But for federally and state recognized indigenous peoples that have no land base, it's always a struggle because you're always living in every space in exile. And so when you
exile in your own land,
and it goes back to being place-based people, and to take it back to where we started our conversation with the Puritans, they were all about the land, gold, God and glory, right? And all about the dispossession of indigenous peoples' lands and exterminating indigenous peoples. And I think that is why it's so crucial that Americans not believe the propaganda that it functions as a central axis of their civic identity as Americans, that this propaganda regarding, you know, the myth of Thanksgiving is so embedded in people's psyche, their sense of identity, in the culture, that we need to decolonize that. People need to think about living differently, right? They need to think about thinking differently, and that means having relationships with everything, with each other, with the plants, you know, with the animals. And people should acknowledge, you know, the mourning of our ancestors that were right. involuntary participants in genocide. And people should understand whose lands they live on and the living history of the people's lands that they occupy.
So well said, and deal with the cognitive dissonance. I know it's hard for people to think that you're living in a place where there was mass slaughter, mass genocide. Larry, when can people catch your show? Real quick.
American Indian Airways broadcasts every Thursday here on KPFK from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m.
Right, and I imagine can be found online. And if you go to the KPFK calendar, I think likely some of the thanks-taking events are being listed. So we're out of time. We're going to have to wrap it up. Larry, we want to thank you.
Thank you.
We want to thank Irene for helping us to put this together, and our engineer, Lizette Tapia, Ramiro Funes, our assistant producer, all who helped to make this show possible. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you so very much for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m. Next up is Radio Zine Presents. 20 years after, since the Battle of Seattle, globalization, anarchism, and indie media.
Oasis, take four.
Window. One, two, and y'all see it, y'all feel it. Feel it.
Oasis, take four.
One, two.
KBOO is having our annual book and record sale Saturday, December 21st from 12 to 10 p.m. There's a special member-only preview hour from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. The sale will be located at Jupiter Next in the Arium Ballroom at 900 East Burnside Street. KBOO is currently accepting donations of used and good condition books, records, CDs, and cassette tapes. KBOO is hosting sorting parties for this event on Friday, December 6th and Friday, December 13th at 5 to 7 p.m. at KBOO's 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. If you're able to help with sorting or help on the day of the sale, please contact volunteer at kboo.org. We hope to see y'all there.
KBOO Community Radio.